Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. This week, we're very excited to do a question and answer episode. It's long overdue. We've been letting them pile up. We've let all of the 420 hate roll in. And so now seems like a good time in order to sit down and answer what they have. Before we jump into the first question, Marshall, what should we share with the people?
Everyone has been crushing it on the bookshop link. It is the store where you can support local booksellers and this store. So go click on the link in the show notes. People have been buying all these really interesting things, not just our recommendations, but also things that they find interesting. If you go through our link, you can purchase whatever you want and still support the show. Secondly, you all are also crushing it when it comes to the Substack. We switched to Thursday afternoons. Our open rate continues to rise. We have lots of great feedback on the 420 episode. So everyone who is ticked off about the 420 related question we have coming up, be sure to go to the Substack and you will see a variety of positive and negative takes on the issue. Finally, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Let's get to the first question.
Just a reminder, if you guys want to ask us a question, go ahead and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. You can write your question within the review. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, no worries. Take a screenshot of your 5-star review, send it into realignmentpod@gmail.com. Got a mix of questions from all over the place here. First one is from an unintelligible username, Inspiring 420 episode. The episode with Dr. Sabet was fantastic. It spurred me to think more seriously about how marijuana has become more visible in my life and what to do about it. After my state legalized the drug, it has become extremely common, now even among kids who I believe never would have used it if it was illegal. My question would be to you, how could a young person advocate caution and temperance on this issue without coming off as a complete narc? What do you think, Marshall?
It's a great question because it gets to what you and I were trying to do in the episode, which is this wasn't supposed to be reefer madness. It's not supposed to be scaremongering. It's just asking some good questions about, hey, what does it look like when you have a massive industry that's incredibly commercialized come out of nowhere? So the main thing you can do is not to focus on converting people to think that weed is bad or that it's dangerous or there's this epidemic of people driving high. It's just to ask really smart structural questions about what's going on here. Hey, if we legalize marijuana, is it going to be tied to decriminalization? Is it going to be tied to letting people out of jail? Is it going to be tied to helping small business owners? Or is it a big, massive corporation that's going to control the industry? That's really important.
Yeah, I mean, my point would be that, which is that there actually is a huge difference between decriminalization and legalization if you do care about disparities in the criminal justice system and more. And look, nobody thinks that it's fair to be locked up for dealing marijuana, but we also have to acknowledge the negative externalities that come from things. I was actually just sharing this with some friends of mine, and people always ask me, well, what about alcohol? And here me is addressing just how bad alcohol is. South Africa apparently banned alcohol sales from March 27th to June 1st of last year, and the murder rate during that time fell by 36%. I'm not saying you should ban alcohol, but what I'm saying is that people who always use it as a counter should acknowledge the negative effects of that. And I think the same thing should come from the legal and regulatory regime around marijuana when we're talking about those types of issues.
Can I ask a quick question about that study? I mean, can I ask? Of course, I'm going to ask a question about that study. I saw people respond to that on Twitter, and what they pointed out was that happened during the lockdown period. That's why they were banning alcohol. So I'm just curious. Mm-hmm. I'm almost certain the study must have accounted for this, but how does that compare the fact that people weren't going outside? I mean, I'm guessing it's probably people aren't committing in-home domestic violence or something like that, but do you have any thoughts on that?
There's a good counter to that, which is that here in the United States, during that same period when we were having a lockdown, guess what happened? Our murder rate went up by 36%. Not exactly 36%, but actually a pretty decent amount during the exact same period, both anecdotal and now the crime stats are in showing the highest murder rate since 1995 all throughout the period of the lockdown. So it's actually a useful counter to a lot of people who say that the murder rate in the United States is only up because of the pandemic. There's a lot of other stuff that's going on. Okay, what's next?
Yeah, and just a quick thing. Good homework for people. Whoever wants to delve more deeply into those statistics, I know there are going to be people on both sides who are very offended, send us the facts. I'd love to feature it in the newsletter. It'd be good to dive into that data. People are loving people do contributions like this. Next question. This is from Diana Boss 33. Love the show. Y'all are great. So y'all often talk about here and on Rising about quote unquote Washington brain, and how politicians often get into power and lose touch with their voters, don't understand what they actually think. Unfortunately, in my home, a Dallas suburb, we are living a small version of that issue. For example, the city council isn't listening to the people and basically bully each other when new members are elected to vote how they want rather than how the voters overwhelmingly want them to. Outside of voting them out, which isn't working, what do we do to change our local politics and break up some of the mini Washington brain mentalities on display here?
It's a good question. I think what you're really getting to, Diana, is the nationalization of all politics. And that is, frankly, just a negative externality of the internet. So until you can solve that, I don't really have an answer for you. And I really wish that I did. But the thing is that the internet has essentially made it so that all politics is national absolutely everywhere. You saw that during the 2020 election when like secretaries of states in Michigan and Georgia and Wisconsin and all these people became hot button issues. You can see it happening what's right now in Arizona. You can see it what's happening in the lieutenant governor's races across the country. And basically, I don't know if there is a quote unquote way out, except for maybe to think differently as a citizenry about how we filter that type of information.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on this. And actually, we're going to cover this very topic next month in May. So come here for more on that. But several things. One, let's interrogate the way you're describing the question, Diana Boss. So you're saying politicians come to DC and they lose touch with their voters. The key thing is, who are their voters? Do you live in a district that's a swing district, or do you live in a district that's primarily Democratic or primarily Republican? If it's a district which is in a swing district and it's in the control of one party, it's likely they are actually listening to their voters, but the voters in question are the primary voters in the electorate. So I would just push back on the idea that what happens in DC is politicians show up and then just are totally unresponsive to anything. I think if you look at a variety of issues across the spectrum, everything from immigration to China, to trade, all of that is completely negated by that. When there are consequences for certain policy decisions, voter sentiment actually really does matter. I think the bigger issue that you actually see happen here is that there are a whole set of issues that are incredibly important, but just either aren't reflected during primaries, so aka the bases of either party don't really care, or just aren't at the front of anyone's mind, so it's easy to focus on it. So for example, if it's 1998, no one is thinking about financial reform. So it's very easy to see Wall Street have a lot of control there. But to the second point, how do you change the local politics? I think what you do is you actually identify issues that have to be held folks accountable to. So whether that's affordable housing, whether it's permitting, whether it's a issue if your local school, the way to actually activate political responses is establish a situation where inaction or taking the quote unquote wrong stand will actually result in a loss. You got to do the work of identifying something like that.
Next thing is a book recommendation from Tucker Cheese. I think that's the right one. Book recommendation from Marshall and Sagar. First, a book recommendation. You guys have totally to read the book The Fourth Turning by Neil Howe and William Strauss. It's an amazing work of American history viewed through a generational lens. It explains a lot about why culture has shifted how it has since World War II. They also coined the term millennial in 1997, and it's spot on about this generation's mindset.
I wanted to respond to this directly before we respond to Tucker Chiz. I think it's Tucker Chiz's question. Tucker Chiz, you are the 10th person who has written in recommending this book. So I bought it on Amazon. Oops, not Bookshop. Go to Bookshop. Don't be like me. I bought it. Man, it came literally the same day. It was incredible.
That's crazy.
It was actually crazy. Ordered it at 8 a.m. It came at 6 p.m. I have no idea what warehouse has copies of this book ready to go. But point is, I bought the book. So we love it when you all give us recommendations and articulate why it's interesting. So I bought it and just wanted to call that out.
Okay, now let's get to the question. Do you guys think that the U.S. will accept a fate of long-term population decline? East Asia is facing population decline right now, shows little intention to bring in immigrants. Europe is facing a nativist backlash for the immigration that's invited in the last decade. Family size continues to shrink. I'm pro-immigration. I want a growing USA. But you guys often talk about tight labor markets regarding worker wages. Do you think the U.S. will allow itself to shrink in size, or will we snap out of our coma when we realize this trend? Will there be a baby boom, immigration wave, or a period of decline? Predictions and opinions.
I love the way Tucker Chiz framed this question because it just gets at how complicated this debate actually is. A frustration I have with folks on the populist right who are immigration restrictionist but also want to increase family size is the fact that actually a lot of experiments to increase family size, either through expanding child tax credits, family policy experiments like cash payments for families, haven't really been that effective. So if the issue is that we want to go from 1.6 children per family to 1.7, they can nudge things that direction, but there hasn't been a policy when it comes to actual families that's nudged a population back to replacement rate just through cash payments. And then this is where immigration comes in. This is definitely an issue which I haven't quite made my mind up on, but I'm increasingly sympathetic to the idea that while it's completely legitimate to be restrictionist on low-skilled immigration, to oppose guest worker programs, other things that are literally designed to lower the actual wages of American and Native workers, I actually do think there is going to have to be some form of immigration increase to deal with this. I'm just not seeing any examples of this being handled. And if you're on the populist right and you disagree with me, I would love to hear people offer suggestions of how you balance the fact that we actually, due to the nature of our entitlement programs, need to have a growing population. B, it's actually very difficult to pay people just to have more children. And C, we do have a difficult dynamic around immigration. So I would just love to hear people who disagree with me offer a counter.
You know, it's interesting. It just comes to my mind. I think this is what somebody would say. I actually think the American case is different than the European case because you're referring, I think, to Hungary there. And the thing is that I think that given our own survey data shows that women and families in particular want 2.2 kids but are only having 1.6, and that the number one reason they cite, it's not necessarily cash relief, it's more structural things. So either having childcare or some sort of payment in order to be able to stay home, or you know, the ability to not have such a long commute, home ownership, student debt, lack of marriageability, et cetera. I actually think in America, it might be more money related than in Europe, given the size of their welfare states that are already, and they also just have very different secular cultural dynamics, which are going on there. All that being said, I do think it is a problem. And actually, literally, while we're taping this, census data came out. We had the second lowest growing rate, I believe that it is, growth rate for our 10-year census in modern American history. I think that's a problem. And by the way, before we even say it, that's only up until 2020, doesn't account for coronavirus deaths or any of that. So second lowest, we only grew by about 7% over 10 years. That's a huge problem because our entire economy, consumption structure, and entitlement program, like Marshall said, are literally built on replacement rate at the very least of the ability to do that. So I think this is something that we should passionately look into.
What's interesting there is we're getting at people who are advocating these issues needing to come up with what they think the problem is. So for example, if you think the problem is that America does not have enough people in it, you should definitely go check out Matt Iglesias' episode of us and think, hey, we should radically expand the amount of money we're putting towards family, change the structure of America, and let more immigrants in. That could be one take. If you think a huge problem is that America isn't as culturally uniform as it needs to be, and you think that there's a huge issue when it comes to low-skilled immigration undercutting worker wages, you could say, hey, I actually prioritize population less than I prioritize cultural solidarity. That's all fine, but I just think too often people don't understand that there's a degree of trade-off between these different parts. And you could totally be correct, Sagar, about how the U.S. is different than Europe. As I understand it, though, there's just like not proof that that's going to work. So maybe we could run a 10-year experiment.
About to have some from this Biden child payments and child credits, especially if they expand it. That actually will be about as good as proof as we get as to whether I'm right or not. And
can you explain what those are?
So these
are the child payments.
Okay, so these Biden child tax credits, this is something which was passed in the American Rescue Plan. So basically, the Democrats are actually pushing in order to make it permanent in the future. But what it does is it gives families up to $3,600 per child for 2021, depending on the age of that child. So for example, families with kids under the age of six get $3,600 per kid, while those with kids between age 6 and 17 get about $3,000 per kid annually. That's up from a maximum of $2,000 per kid under the age of 17. And that is basically has a height of family income up to $150,000 a year. So that's majority of the U.S. population, vast majority of the U.S. population. It's going to be really interesting. Now, a one-off experiment necessarily isn't going to tell you much, but because they are pushing hard in order to make this permanent, let's say we get this thing in for 5 years, that's about as good evidence as you need as to whether this is a cash problem or not. I'm anxiously awaiting to see the results of that data. Like, for example, what if we get a baby boom as a result? But given the pandemic, lockdown, you know, craziness, all of that, it could also be different externalities. So I'd like to see it run for a couple of years before we figure out whether that's true or not.
Well said. Next question is from a concerned millennial asking the right questions. I enjoy your podcast and Rising. Both shows speak to me as asking the nuanced questions we need to ask if we're to move past the generation of our parents' governance, which leads to my question. Biden has stated that the U.S. intends to withdraw from the Middle East. And while I agree with the idea, I imagine there will be negative effects, economic or otherwise, to the U.S. because of the decision. There are profits to be made off of war. What happens when those profits disappear? Quick thing, I think this question is so fascinating because it totally goes a different direction than I was expecting. So this person, I'm guessing a concerned millennial, you're on the left. So you're starting with withdraw from the Middle East, but then you're embracing the idea of a military industrial complex that determines US foreign policy to make money. But then you're also saying, but wait, that foreign policy employs people. So that's just a direction I did not see coming.
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny. I don't worry. The defense contractors will be fine in case you're worried about the stimulus there. No, the people who are screwed, frankly, are the direct military subcontractors who rely on Afghanistan. I don't think they make up that much percentage of our GDP. And actually, most of the money is directly allocated to Afghanistan itself. So in terms of the money or whatever that's going to be lost from that, it will not be directly affect the U.S. economy. Also, in terms of stimulative effects, there are 10 times more efficient ways to spend your money if you want to stimulate the economy.
What's fascinating about this is it also gets to, and you hit this, Sagar, when you talked about the contractors, the nature of what the Afghan war is. You want to know what the military industrial complex is? It's the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter project, which has gone on for decades, is ridiculously over budget. It was originally intended to be a low-cost replacement for the F-22 Raptor. It's now incredibly expensive. The F-35 has nothing to do with the war in Afghanistan. It's not about counterinsurgency. It's not about fighting the Taliban. It's all about great power conflict. The types of things that really actually get the Pentagon, all those things together, are big weapon systems. They are fighter planes. They are actual ships in the Navy. None of those things have anything to do with the style of wars that we really fought against ISIS or that we fought in Afghanistan. So to your point, Sagar, this person could be rest assured a final end of the Afghan conflict, knock on wood, will pretty much have nothing to do with that broader structure.
Yeah, they're going to be just fine. I'm sure the F-35 needs some bullshit repair in the next 2 months. Okay, Rick, dear Marshall and Sagar, I hope this email finds you well. I'm emailing to ask if you're planning to launch a Patreon or Supercast account. I would be happy to become a supporter and get a realignment mug. I'm a huge fan of the show. Y'all are the future. Thank you for the great conversations. All the best from Iowa, Rick. Well, shout out to Iowa, Rick.
Rick, A, thank you so much for writing this in. We've thought really hard for a long time about how we want to monetize the podcast. And I can say that this next month in May, we are actually going to launch a Supercast. A bunch of other people also wrote in as well too, saying they want to support the show with that. What Supercast is it is a subscription podcasting option. So the good news for everyone, we are still going to publish the same original numbers of shows. You'll still get your Tuesday show. You'll still get your Thursday show if you're not paying, but we'll also do bonus episodes. We'll also do special Q&A sessions, Zoom calls, different parts like that. And we'll also have the mugs too. So this is a great way to support us if you want to go deeper into the realignment. The episode I'm so pumped to do, so many of you loved our episode of Frank DiStefano. So Sagar and I are going to sit down with Frank and we're going to go as long as we need to go all the way through his work. That's the perfect example of what we're going to do there.
Also, if we promised you a free mug, don't worry. I know it's late. This entire process has actually turned Marshall and I kind of into boomer Republicans. They're like, do you know how hard it is to start a small business? Because honestly, it's pretty annoying. Bank accounts, LLC, you got to file this paperwork, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it is coming, my people. We promise. If we promised you a free mug, you're going to get your free mug. If not, it's going to launch right around the same time. It will be available for all of you, and I hope that you guys stay tuned. We have some big announcements that are on the horizon. Next question from Steven. Can I contribute to you guys in any way other than financially? I'm bilingual and bicultural. I taught high school math and economics for 10 years. During COVID, I tried a bunch of new things. The craziest have been podcasting, a YouTube channel, a merchandise shop, even a Substack where I write in Chinese. Wow, that's wild. And at last, hope you guys had a wonderful 420 and keep up the great work. How can he support us in a non-financial way, Marshall? How can the diehards help us out here, even if they don't have any money?
So this is a great question because the question before this was, how can you support us financially? You could subscribe to our Supercast next month. You'll hear more about that. But we totally get that a lot of you all are still in high school. You're still in college. This is why we are not going to reduce the amount of content that we're going to do. Instead, the number one thing you could do to help us right now, if it's not financial, is you can go through the more than 120 episodes that we have released. You can pick 3 or 4, even 5 of them, and actually send them to people who don't listen to the show and would enjoy them. That's what you can do. So rather than just going and saying, hey, this is the Q&A episode, I'm going to send this to my dad. That won't help us because it's a Q&A episode. This is for the diehards. Your dad doesn't know who we are. Instead, if it turns out your dad really likes Hollywood because he was bemoaning the Oscars 2 nights ago, guess what? Send him our episode of Ben Fritz from the Wall Street Journal. Hey, if your younger brother is super into crypto, send him our episode of Biology, so on and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and just so people know, we have looked into this in terms of what is the best way to spread a podcast. And now look, we have asked you guys 5-star review. That's a huge part of it. But honestly, organic word of mouth, you can't beat it. There's no other way in order to help us out than just say, hey, to a friend, I like this pod. If you have 45 minutes or whatever, check out this interview. That is the ultimate thing that you can entrust both to us and to your friend. And so if the pod means something to you, we've humbly asked that you do that. It's apparently, and research has even shown this, the number one way in order to spread the word. Absent Twitter, absent Instagram, YouTube, all of that, unless you're going on Joe Rogan's show in order to talk about what you're doing, this is the best way that you can do anything about us. Okay.
Next question. My name is Jackson. I'm a 23-year-old restaurant chain owner operator from Michigan. By most metrics, I've done very well. My business continues to grow and we do over $5 million a year in annual revenue. Congrats on pulling that off during COVID, Jackson. I did very well in school. However, I don't possess any elite credentials or a college degree, given the fact that I've been building this business for the last 5 years. Despite this, I'm seemingly unable to escape the fact that my passion is politics and more specifically, policy. I believe the best path in doing what I want would likely be a policy-oriented organization, crafting specific policies and proposals, or trying to craft new ideological frameworks for candidates in the future, using my experience as an entrepreneur and my background as a millennial from a swing state. Something like Orrin Cass's American Compass or the Claremont Institute comes to mind. So what I would like to know is, how the hell do I go about going to work for one of these places? Do I need to meet the right people to get my foot in the door? Am I enough on paper as it is? Would it require me to go to university and get a degree before I'm ever taken seriously, despite my background as a business owner? Or to be broader, do you even believe a job in that vein would be the best fit? I'm not motivated by money, just an overwhelming compulsion to do everything in my power to have a better future in the country. So I'm open to other avenues. And by the way, we've gotten this email from so many people. There's 15 different versions of this. So definitely listen up if you're into that. Sagar, what do you think about this?
It's a good question, Jackson. I would reject that. And I don't know if you've been listening to our podcast closely enough, but I think things are changing. And I do not believe that needing to go through some of these so-called credentialing institutions, especially in terms of politics, I won't say the same thing as college. That one is definitely not there yet. But in terms of having to go work at a think tank, having to come and get some DC credential or whatever, I'm not saying it wouldn't be useful. I actually do think it would be. But if you're looking at it as the main barrier to your entry into political office, I just don't think that's the case. You said in your question that you're from Michigan and you're a successful small business owner. You probably know the correct people in order to speak to, the so-called power brokers there. And also, with the nationalization of politics, the flattening of everything with the internet, there are not the same number of roadblocks for somebody like you that there just used to be. And so I would say to try and find what the uncovered so-called political niche in your area is, what kind of office, this is crucial, not that you want to run for, but that you think you're actually qualified for. Take a look at what that actually runs up against. Get some experience. Learn how things work. I see no reason why you couldn't just jump straight into it. Marshall, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's two parts of this, and this is the thing which is really difficult for people, some a little more pessimistic than you are, Sagar. If you're saying, how do I come to traditional DC and work at a think tank or for a traditional member of Congress, you are correct. There are going to be gaps in your experience that are going to be a huge issue. The lack of college degree, the lack of knowing people. These institutions are not set up to bring people in like you. And what's so frustrating about being here in DC is that there are just so many people with all those credentials who are desperate for their own foot in the door that actually they basically just don't need to take the time to get to know you personally. That's just the reality of the situation. So what I think is best to do in this context is just think really hard about the fact that, hey, I've made these choices in my life. They're really working out for me and they're clearly working out for you. Some doors are closed, other doors are opened. So because you've actually run a business, you have actual tangible skills to provide somebody. You're not going to just be another law school grad or person with a random MPP. You have actual skills. You have actual talents, which to Sagar's point, you can really portray and offer up on the local level. But the other thing that I will positively state for you is this is where Twitter and the internet are incredibly important. An organization that you should look into is one which Sagar is on the board of, and we appeared on their podcast. It's American Moment. American Moment is led by Saurabh Sharma, Nick Solheim, and Jake Mercier. And they are, guess what? They are all young people. Jake hasn't graduated from college. Nick dropped out of college, and Saurabh just graduated from college. So if you're looking for an organization that's on the right, as you currently seem to be, that is not going to care about your college credentials, they are the ones to check out. Look them up. You can find their stuff. It's American Moment.
All right. Next question. Last question. Hey guys, you two are crushing the game. Love listening to your episodes. I don't have a question. I wanted to tell you something funny. I'm from Chicago. I was watching the Cubs game and a commercial for Hooters came on. And for some reason, it caught my attention. It wasn't what I saw, but what I heard, it was their music that made me think of your podcast. The music they use in their commercial is the same intro music you have. I didn't know if that was your music, if you purchased it from a site or got it for free. I just thought I would let you know in case you needed to go with battle with Hooters over this. Anyways, keep crushing the game and have a great rest of your week. Sorry if there are grammar issues. I'm writing on my phone. That actually was one of the best written questions of all of this. So shout out to you.
Dude or ma'am, in this case, that was very comprehensible. We could read it out loud without having to edit. Sometimes we have to do that as we're looking through this. But A, we do not own the rights to the song. Actually, Phil Hegseth, the producer, just went through a site and found a couple different examples. And this is the example we loved. The key thing is we found the ad, and the ad is not good. It's really weird, because the reason why I like the intro is it's kind of jazzy and jaunty and we're walking down the street, but that doesn't really make any sense in the context of Hooters. So maybe this explains why they're a second tier restaurant chain. No offense to any Hooters executives or friends who may listen to the podcast out there.
Okay, that does it for us. We have a really exciting episode for you guys on Thursday. As always, a special shout out to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. Make sure you go and check out our bookshop where you can either purchase any of the guests who have been on the show, their book, or you can purchase any book you want. It helps our show here at The Realignment, and it helps an independent bookstore during COVID-19.
And to any of you who are still listening at this point in the show, we are not publishing the video for this podcast, but we are publishing the video on our YouTube of our Ross Douthat interview, which we did not post a month or so ago when he came on. So definitely go to YouTube and check out the link if you want to watch Sagar, Ross, and me. It's a great conversation.
See you guys on Thursday.